Welcome to the Retail Exchange Podcast.
It's not just about things like, you know, returns or those kinds of processes, but also thinking about how we cross-sell products. So our store teams are very good at outfitting our customers and not just focusing on the one thing that the customer thinks they've come in for, but building a full outfit. You know, we take that experience and we try and mirror that as closely as we can online, because that's where the expertise in our business lies. It's our store stylists putting together outfits for customers. We take that online and deliver a digital experience that replicates that.
Sometimes the highest spenders are the highest maintenance customers who have no loyalty. And why should they? You know, for them, it's about they can shop anywhere. So remember that.
Hello. Welcome to the Retail Exchange Podcast. I'm Carl McKeever. In this latest episode of In Focus, recorded live at Fortnum & Mason's flagship store in London, we'll hear from Bryony Yates, Senior CX Manager at Seasalt Cornwall, Matthew Henton, Head of E-commerce at Moss, Kelly Kaur, Enterprise Customer Success Manager at Narvar, and retail expert Sarah Curran. These industry leaders share real-world examples and actionable advice on how to get the most value out of every customer relationship. Customer acquisition costs continue to increase, so finding ways to build deeper, longer-lasting relationships with shoppers is more important than ever, and luxury retailers aren't immune. We'll explore the strategies and best practices to optimise the post-purchase experience, maximise customer lifetime value, and keep customers coming back. Here's the episode. Okay, well, I'd like to begin by, first of all, welcoming everybody to Fortnum & Mason, fantastic luxury department store here in London's West End. Actually, it's a brand which featured on an earlier episode of the Retail Exchange podcast. So if you have the opportunity, do listen back to that particular episode in April where we were talking about customer relationships, customer retention, and very much carrying on the themes which we'll be talking about today. So I'm not just going to take a moment just to get each of my guests here today the opportunity to just introduce themselves and their role as a quick overview. So if I may begin with you, please, Bryony.
I come from a design background, so that's why I relocated to Seasalt to work as a designer. My line manager, who is Adam Cockgrave, who has been at Seasalt for 18 years now, started a customer experience department just over 4 years ago and reached out to me and said, hey, what do you think about CX? And I said, what's CX? And I learned all about it, took up the opportunity, and I have never looked back. I seem to kind of think of myself as going from creative designing to creative thinking about designing the experience. So being in a new CX world and championing everything that that brings to our customer and what that means for the brand and growing as a business is just what I live and breathe.
And Matthew, you're joining us here today from Moss, and I think, again, perhaps a brand which for many people will think about formal hire wear. Perhaps it's, you know, when you get married or you have a special day, many shoppers will go to Moss to be decked out for their special occasion.
Closely associated with those special occasions in life, like weddings and formal celebrations and Royal Ascot and so on. And we are a brand which is relatively new compared to the wonderful place that we're in today, Fortnum & Mason. But Moss has actually been around since 1851. First store was just up the road in Covent Garden. We have had that close association to those sort of big moments in people's lives ever since then.
Kelly, I guess for you, the clue is in the title of your role.
It is.
But as Customer Enterprise Success Manager, what's the key highlights of what you do?
So I'm really lucky to work with Bryony and Matt. I work really closely with them to understand what's important to them. I think in my role as Customer Success Manager is making sure that I'm completely aligned with what my customers want to achieve, meeting their expectations to meet their customers' needs, and making sure that we're constantly making recommendations, best practices, and pushing them to deliver the best post-purchase experience that they can.
So which of them is more demanding? Bryony or Matt?
I'm lucky that neither of them. I love working with them
both.
What
a great answer. Full diplomat.
Very diplomatic. Very.
Excellent. So Sarah, sitting there quietly on the end, what do you do?
My background has been digital retail since 2005 when I launched a multi-brand retailing platform. And then I did another one for the Very Group in their premium proposition. And then I moved from one side of the desk to the other and got involved in tech and SaaS. And now I've joined Narva. And I think for me, I've always been really passionate about looking at what are the priorities that the shopper is having. And now the priority is very much beyond the buy button. So it's about really driving that additional added value. It's about ensuring that you're maximizing customer satisfaction and your NPS. You know, this is where you win at customer lifetime value. That's where you win at retention. The cost of customer acquisition these days is really expensive, but it's also extremely noisy. So by understanding, you know, the key priorities, I know that we've got Corney and Barrow in the room, and so they have a very particular type of customer. It's sort of fine wines and spirits. So it's not necessarily going to be the high returning, but that customer is going to be, if not more demanding than maybe a luxury or premium fashion accessories or food consumer. And so it's really about understanding in that post-purchase journey, where can you differentiate, where can you drive customer sort of added value, and also ensure that you really delight. Because now I think there are some stats about 70% of customers who have a negative post-purchase experience will not return and make a purchase. So these are really critical sort of areas to focus on in that digital journey beyond the buy button.
Well, Sarah, thank you for that fantastic warm-up into the conversations that we're going to have this morning.
I'll be quiet now.
No, not by no means at all. So if we could show some appreciation for the panel and let's get underway. And I'm going to begin my first question with you, Brian. You have the pleasure of sitting next to me, so I'm going to direct everything to you first.
Absolutely.
How do you ensure a consistent experience throughout the customer journey, regardless of channel? You know, we're aware that people can shop in various ways, but, you know, surely there shouldn't be a difference in experience. Or if there is a difference, that it's relevant to what that channel is and where it fits in with the mix.
Absolutely. So we work as a CX team very closely to our customer services team, equally with our retail team. So we work on a piece more broadly as a department called Unified Service. And what we do is exactly what you've just described. We identify what's the ideal best experience we can offer a customer for a particular journey. We identify that. Then we break it down by channel. We understand where we can make that kind of mirror image. And then we look at, you can't replicate that in a customer services agent. You can't replicate that online. So what's the best experience for that channel specifically? And then we work down as kind of a ladder effect, how we can deliver those so that we can be sure that those gaps and differences are catered for.
And presumably there are some parts which you try to retain, which are common with kind of the ethos and the values of the brand, for example.
Absolutely. We're very keen to support our kind of employer values that then resonate with our customers. That's what they know and love about our service. We make sure that the narrative that we give to our retail teams and our customer services agents are exactly the same. All of the training is the same. All of the support tools are the same. We hold monthly forums with both of those departments to make sure that we're consistent. It's not an easy task. There are gaps and there's things that we can always improve and learn upon. So to have those forums on a monthly cadence just make sure that we're keeping on top of those and we're listening to VOC, voice of customer, to make sure that we're finding those gaps and addressing them as best we possibly can.
And Matthew, is that similar or different to what you would do at Mars?
Very similar. Our starting point for everything that we deliver is that the customer experience should be the same, whether they are physically in one of our stores or whether they're interacting with us online, wherever that is possible. I mean, obviously, the nature of the medium means that it isn't always possible, but that is our starting point and our assumption. And it's not just about things like, you know, returns or those kinds of processes, but also thinking about how we cross-sell products. So our store teams are very good at outfitting our customers and not just focusing on the one thing that the customer thinks they've come in for, but building a full outfit. You know, we take that experience and we try and mirror that as closely as we can online, because that's where the expertise in our business lies. It's our store stylists putting together outfits for customers. We take that online and deliver a digital experience that replicates that.
And Kelly, how can technology help with that process where you try and get that consistency of service and, you know, removing as much friction from the process as possible?
It's interesting. And actually, it's something that I noticed Seasalt did beautifully. So I did a test purchase as working with them, trying to understand the journey myself, putting myself in a customer's shoes to be able to walk through and experience their post-purchase experience. And as part of that, I did a click and collect and went into their store and picked it up. And everything that Bryony has said about the online and offline is exactly the same. Everything is really thoughtful in the touch points that they're having. So it feels like even with our communications and even with the tracking page to allow customers to keep up to date on where their order is, and even returning the items, everything is consistent. And I think that wasn't the case before. So now customers see all of this post-purchase as an extension of the customer experience, which is so important and really helps to build that brand loyalty and customer loyalty that I think Seasalt and Moss have done perfectly.
And in your role, Matt, I guess that you must have a variety of platforms and different tools which are involved in delivering service to customers when they're shopping online. What has driven your, I suppose, your thought process in terms of when you've selected products or vendors which are going to be complementary to that process?
Yeah, I mean, vendor selection for, you know, all of the services that we offer, whether it's post-purchase or whether it's, you know, part of the e-com platform and the services that we provide, it's really about, does it enhance the customer experience? Are we able to replicate the you know, amazing experience that we deliver in stores better digitally by bringing on new technology vendors or providers? And how easy are those platforms and services to use internally? You know, are we able to sort of hit the ground running as an e-commerce team or a trading team and actually, you know, deliver value quickly with those kind of services?
And for you, Brian, how have you approached that whole philosophy, I guess, of almost streamlining your operations to make them fit?
Yes. So when we look at new technologies or vendors, we go through our kind of usual business processes. But I think from a customer experience point of view, that's always been our kind of main purpose and main goal. If it doesn't achieve exactly what we want to have as the end outcome, that will then tailor what we choose and what we go after. So in terms of Narvar, we knew that the quality of the delivery of the customer experience was really key, and it delivered all of our expectations, especially in those digital touch points, which is so hard to replicate and really important, as Kelly had mentioned. Mm-hmm. So that was really important for us. Making sure that that aligned with our other systems and operations is really critical, because if it breaks something else down the chain, we will then create more poor experiences that we will then have to go and fix.
And did you encounter any physical challenges there to enable one thing, something else had to flex or go or be modified?
Yes, the main one that can come to mind is going paperless with our returns. So we had the traditional A4 piece of paper where you would read your reasons for return, tick your box, put your name and your item and put that back in the parcel. As part of our returns journey, we wanted to go paperless for our sustainability values, which aligns with our brand, but also to move forward in this kind of digital endeavour that actually that's the way that process should be. And it doesn't need to be kind of a paper offline experience. Mm. It can be digital, it can be easy for the customer to log that return and follow their return journey straight the way through.
So why was there pain involved in getting rid of the paper?
Any change to a customer and a process has an impact. So for the customer, it was, I'm used to getting my paper. What's happened? You've taken it away from me. So there's a bit of kind of change management from that perspective. Operationally, that's how our DC run. And we also fulfill orders from our store locations in the UK. So to change that operation from the dispatch notes into a paperless solution is definitely a change for multiple teams and departments. Mm.
Did you find any issues like that as well, Matthew, at Moss, when you were trying to implement change?
And not particularly when it came to post-purchase. I think, you know, when we implemented Narvar, we were exactly the same, Bryony. We, you know, had a dispatch note that had a couple of, you know, sticky labels that you would peel off with your chosen courier, take it to the post office. Or
I can't tell you the amount of times, by the way, I've got to interrupt, where I've actually sealed up my box and I've taped it beautifully and then realised I didn't put it in the damn packing slot. Yeah. I mean, am I the only person that's ever done that?
No.
Yeah. That really common. And I think, look, I think there were several things about that process that we found challenging. One was just the amount of people that actually did tick the relevant box to tell us why they were returning things. So we were blind to a significant proportion of our customers' actual return reasons, which is then not helpful for us to try and understand what it is about the product that the customer wasn't satisfied with and needed to return. The other thing is that we offer an online exchange service, and we also wanted to drive our customers to return into store wherever possible. We've got 110 stores across the UK, so it's reasonably convenient for most of our customers to drop off at store. And the reason for that is, obviously, from our perspective, that gives us an opportunity to retain sales value, but also from a customer's perspective, it just allowed us to find out why the customer wasn't satisfied with the product and find the right product for them. And normally that's down to sizing. Most men are not buying tailoring product that often, and size can be a challenge. We offer four different fits, slim, tailored, regular, and relaxed fit. Most guys are not familiar with how those fits wear on them. So To get sizing wrong in tailoring product when you're buying online is very easy. Mm-hmm. And to put that right, we can offer by far the best service if customers return to one of our stores. And I think if it was just so easy to peel off that label and stick it on the parcel and return it to us, it just did not give the customer that opportunity to understand or to share the reasons why they weren't satisfied with the product. And so we were able to build that encouragement into a digital process in a way that a kind of peel off the sticky label process just could never convey. Mm. So having a customer then, go online, tell us that they want to return and tell us the reasons why they want to return, and then we can show them the nearest store that they can take that product to, get some advice and potentially, exchange for a different product or even a different service from us. That was really transformational for us.
Sarah, I think that Bryony and Matt have both illustrated in very real ways some of the challenges which are involved in a sense, almost creating that offline experience and the expectations that customers have into an online world. How different and difficult is it for brands to really embrace that as a philosophy?
I think it's so complex that you have to almost understand your target demographic, your core audience. You have to understand what their expectation is in terms of how digitally advanced you can be, because you have to always be in step with their sort of habits, their daily habits. And also understand, sometimes when you look at range, you kind of look at the range and you think, okay, there are going to be areas which are not sort of high returners, there will be areas that are. And there'll be areas where actually you can push for an exchange for the customer, or understand if they come into store, then also the business benefits from both that potential to convert a return to an upsell or an exchange, and also you're driving that consumer back into the store. So you're really at that point able to bring more of a sort of a personalized experience as well. So, I mean, I think if you have... if you're bricks and clicks, which I know is an old terminology, I almost think that is just such a gift that you have to be able to play with different ways of connecting emotionally with the customer. But we also have to remember that online, predominantly for the consumer, is about convenience and ease. And it might be that you don't have access to, you're not in London, so you can't go to Liberty or Fortnum & Mason's. There are other retailers also available. I think it's about making sure that the friction points for the consumer, for the shopper, are removed and that experience is enhanced and you have that opportunity to upsell. And you do that through those emotional touch points post-purchase.
Brian, can you give me an example where working with Narvar has helped you to deliver better service to your customers?
Absolutely. And so we started with our return portal journey, making sure that was quick, easy, convenient, and delivered the results that the customer needed and wanted from that transition. But more recently, we delivered our outbound communications and our track page. I think we agree, Kelly and I, that our track page is probably our kind of shining star of that experience. Mm-hmm. Before we had that, the customer couldn't track their order unless they went on the Royal Mail or the DPD website, which is not aesthetic. And is a different user experience and routes the customer elsewhere. So you're kind of making more of these chains in the journey and the effort that they're going to have to make. So to have
a
track page...
And Antonava has supported you in making those changes?
Completely changed it. Okay, having great. A track page that is Seasalt branded. It has all of our content. With the click of a button, the customer can see exactly the history of their order until it's delivered either in-store for click and collect or to their home location.
And how about for you, Matt?
Well, all of that. but also, I think the data that we get as a result of our returns process now has allowed us to much better understand why our customers are not satisfied with the product that they've bought. We are able to now make it really simple for customers to tell us why they are returning the product that they are. And there's a sort of a stepped process within that that they can, you know, we can ask for more information depending on the reasons that the customer gives. And we bring that data on returns back into the business. We combine that with our store returns data, where our store colleagues are asking the same questions for store returns. And then we process all of that data, and we're now able to look at the products that are being returned. We're able to look at it by fit. We're able to look at it by individual size level and by return reasons. A lot of customers will tell us more information, you know, particularly around fit, that it sort of fits in one place but not in another.
And we're I'm a particularly disruptive customer in this process, can I say, because I never give the right answer.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Do you always opt for the first...
No, I actually look at the selection and think which will give them the most grief.
No.
No. That's not what we want.
We need friends. Come on.
I know. Look, I think you know, that there's always going to be a level of inaccuracy in, you know, do people just select
you're going to blacklist
the first
me now,
thing
in the drop-down list. But, it's going to be a checkbox against my name.
I think for everyone, all the retailers and brands.
Be nice to retailers and give the real reason. But I think, look, bringing that information centrally into the business has just really allowed us to understand where, you know, simple things like there is an issue with the photography of the product that we haven't got the colour matching right, and it then doesn't meet customers' expectations. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, something that we can quickly fix. We've found that in certain product ranges, certain parts of the size scale are over-indexing on returns compared with others. And so we've been able to work with our, you know, garment technology specialists to look at those particular areas of concern. And of course, from a business perspective, we're trying to drive that returns rate down. But for, you know, for every point that we reduce that returns rate, that's satisfied customers that didn't need to return something that they bought that got the product that they were satisfied with. So I think the data part of it is, you know, enormous in terms of the impact that it's had on us as a business.
And Kelly, one of the things which retailers have really sought to measure quite hard in recent years is NPS or Net Promoter Score. Mm-hmm. I really have read the notes. Is that still a relevant measure? Is it something that, you know, retailers should really still have on their KPIs?
You're lucky I've spoken to Sarah since she's joined Narvar about this question, because there were times when I questioned whether it was as relevant. Because again, you either get really happy customers or really unhappy customers that tend to give you the feedback, so it's difficult to track. But I think NPS is so important because there are so many people across the business that are looking at the NPS score for their company, seeing how well they're doing. So it's totally, totally relevant. But it's also important, as Matt has just been saying, about to understand why customers are liking your brand. What is it that you're doing well? And if you're not doing something well, learning from that and making the changes.
And what strategies would seem most effective there?
In helping customers to improve their NPS. Mm. So again, giving them an experience that's effortless, frictionless. It's so easy to engage with the brand and the customer. And again, Moss and Seasalt do this beautifully. It's about you're protecting yourself. So the returns portal that they work with allows them to not allow customers to return after the date. It gives you some control. It gives you some data so that you can learn and you can improve and you can look at the products exactly as Matt said. But it also allows the customers to feel part of the brand and the journey from beginning to end. And I think that's really important. So the consistency of information, the level of information that we're proactively providing them with means that they don't have to contact customer services. Everything is convenient. It's all about making it easy for your customer to buy from you, removing any of the challenges and making them ultimately want to spend money with you again.
What do you think are some of the most important things for high value clients?
A personalised experience.
Okay.
I think if you're going to spend a lot of money on an item, you're excited for it. Some people, it will be something they've saved up for a really long time, and you want that online experience to match what it would be like going into store, that same feeling as you walk into the shop and you're delighted by what's around you. You need to have that same delight in the online experience.
And is it the same for all high-value customers? Because I must admit, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that I am a high-value customer, well, occasionally, but there's a fine line, isn't there, between service and intrusiveness?
There is, but again, with segmentation and personalisation, which we can do in Narvar, it helps you to understand your customers, and then you can offer the right experience for them at that part of the journey. So there will be people that buy with you a lot, so therefore you know what type of engagement they want. Do they want you to go over and above? Do they want to have that extra communication? Do they want to be served information about how to look after their beautiful jacket they've just brought? Or is it that it's a first-time purchase, in which case it might be that excitement that they want from it. And again, sending them information to help them get excited about the arrival and let them know that it's on its way. All of those types of
engagement. And how easy is it to get to know a shopper online versus face-to-face? I mean, you know, we can look at each other now and I can interact with you, I can detect your body language, I know that we've got good eye contact, all of those things. And that helps me form a relationship. Online, surely it's much harder to do that.
I don't agree. I think it's easier online because you've got these touch points that you're capturing. So you're really able to build out a picture of that buyer and understanding the journeys that they take based on previous purchases that they've made with you. In store, I might not have interacted with anyone in the store to give you that information. So you are able to collect this information in the touch points along the journey, which help you to serve your customers in a personalised and more segmented way moving forward, which I think is the most important thing about the post-purchase, is understanding your customer and making sure you're serving them with the information they want at the time they
want. So for you, it's very much not a one-size-fits-all?
It's not. It's about the personalisation of the journey. It's about segmenting it. It's about understanding. And it's about driving value at all of the touch points and adding in the information that you think is relevant to them to be able to make them want to engage with the brand more. So like Bryony was saying about the track page, they update the assets on there seasonally. So customers are never going to get the same experience throughout the year. They're going to be served with different information, helping them to really engage with the brand. And I think that's really important.
So Bryony, have you had any particular success with post-purchase engagement tactics?
We have. So our analytics from our track page experiences, kind of click-through rates and kind of marketing engagement has been really, really strong. As Kelly mentioned, the personalisation for each of those track pages based on the part of the journey have been probably the best success. So when you're in transit and you're looking to see where your order is, obviously that has the highest engagement, but what you want to know is your particular multi-shipment order, where are those different pieces in that part of the journey? So the hierarchy of needs is I want to know where my dress, my jacket, my t-shirt are, and then the brand rich content is kind of lower down the page. Once we hit into that product is delivered, all of a sudden you want to know about the wear and the care of the product, or you might want to know recommendations that outfit well with that in particular. So to shift those touch points and make those the most relevant for that part of the journey as a very basic need covers that personalization, because most customers will respond to those types of content pieces at that point.
It always surprises me how different brands approach this in different ways. You know, I shop with brands online all of the time, and quite often some high-end brands as well. And one of my big frustrations is that exactly what you're just describing there. Some brands allow you great visibility at what you can see, both in terms of the track process, but most importantly for me, in terms of the returns process. I might buy multiple sizes, I might buy things which are just on a whim just to see whether I'd like it or not. Or sometimes I'm buying things which actually just didn't suit me. But actually the thing that matters most to me then is, when do I get my money back?
100%.
Yeah, you know, after all is said and done, and I've had that moment of elation or disappointment, the next thing is, right, I need that money back in my account. It really surprises me how some very prestigious brands, and even a couple of the brands in this room, are quite scant on giving customers that level of information.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way that we approach it is we want to have the best journey possible, but we talk about this hierarchy of needs. And even though we want it to be brand rich and have the content and the communications to look sea salty, we make sure that ultimately what's the highest point of importance for that customer, and it's I want my money back.
You know, and does this also matter to you when you're selecting your third-party vendors? So people, for example, like your shippers, again, I'm not mentioning any names, but you know, I could give you a league table of the most effective shippers in the UK based on their level of service. And if I have to call anybody out, I'll say DPD is far and above the best. They give you absolute clarity in terms of where it is, when it's coming. Do you want to change your order? Do you want to change the time? Do you want to leave it with a safe place or a neighbour? Incredible. And not only do they offer that service, they deliver that service on the day. And if I had to call out a rogue, I'd say UPS, because I have the least level of control, visibility, etc., of any of the shippers that I work with. But do you have that level of deep involvement in determining those rules of the game with your third-party vendors?
We do. It's a really important part of the process that we partner and have relationships with carriers that are kind of aligned with our brand values, but also that we can have those relationships to improve what they're delivering. We were talking about this earlier where, you know, the sea salt order experience is very integral to whether Royal Mail deliver that or leave it on your front door out in the rain. So actually, even though that was Royal Mail in that example, it's sea salt. That's their sea salt. And they give that feedback saying, you know, so disappointed my product was left at my front door in the rain. So even though it's kind of our relationship with Royal Mail, that's how we're perceived. So we utilise the feedback within Narvar from those post-purchase journeys, and we take that back to our carrier relationships, and we say, you know, we've had X amount of CSAT feedback through Narvar that we can determine they were scoring one star because of this particular part of the final delivery of their order.
And something that struck me from what you said earlier, Sarah, is, and again, in all of my 35 years plus consulting for retail brands, a philosophy that I adopted very early in that journey was what I call thinking like a customer.
Yeah, totally.
And thinking like a customer means experiencing like a customer and standing on the other side of the counter or the fence or the gate, as it were. Do you think brands do this well enough? In other words, being able to take themselves out of their own internal cogs and cycle and process and actually standing in the customer's shoes and saying, is this good enough? Does this work for me? Is this right? Would I accept this?
I mean, I would say I hope they do remember to think like a customer, but my experience has been that a lot of the time they don't, because there are simple missed opportunities throughout that journey, or a lack of understanding your core demographics priority that leads me to think, no, they're not thinking. There almost is sometimes they're overthinking, trying to be too clever, and they're just missing the basics.
Mm-hmm. I've returned over 150 books to Amazon for one reason: damaged covers.
Oh.
No plastic on the outside, and they've taken the plastic away because of meeting their environmental targets.
Oh.
Having boxes which are oversized for the book that's within and no other packing materials.
Yeah.
So then it's shaken about, thrown about, tossed around on its journey. Who wants a book that's got bent corners, damaged sides, torn fronts?
I think, you know, it's so difficult. And look, we're coming into peak and, you know, wishing everybody a sort of successful golden quarter. But the realities are that sometimes the business priority is volume. It's orders. It's just get them in and ship them out without thinking about that, your experience. I think, you know, particularly with when you look at certain carriers, I remember, you know, God, when I was at one of the previous retailers, you know, we always dreaded peak. Because there'd be some horrific story that was about to break on the Daily Mail about someone's box being thrown over the garden fence and killing a cat, you know? it's just like, or someone's, you know, Christmas present order being just left with a sort of a plant pot on the top and ruined in the rain. And there are just these. It annoys me when we work so hard as brands and retailers to make sure that the experience is great, and then you just have this final mile sloppy ass sort of delivery that then doesn't fall back on the carrier. It falls back on the brand. And again, it's thinking at every single emotional touch point that the consumer has. Is this going to delight, or is it going to sort of absolute sort of disgust? or annoy, or heaven forbid, lose that customer.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the more high end the shopper,
oh, the greater the expectation.
Yeah. And we are obviously at the at the whim of that final mile and the delivery partner. I actually think it would be great, and we can't do this in our business, but I would like to give the choice to the customer, not of express delivery or next day delivery or standard delivery, but actually to pick the courier. Because I think that would make a psychological shift of, well, I chose that courier and then threw it in the hedge or whatever. Unfortunately, we can't do that because we fulfill from our stores as well as our central warehouse. And so we can only offer the service level to the customer, and it then goes into order orchestration, and it might be fulfilled from here or it might be fulfilled from there, and that will determine the courier choice. But I would love to do it. I would love to just give the customer that choice. I rate personally Evri as a fantastic courier. And I know some people do not, and some people will say that they're the worst courier that they've ever experienced. But personally, delivering to my house, they're brilliant. I would always choose Evri if I was given that choice by a retailer. So yeah, I would love to do it. I'd love to just give the customer.
I feel we're going
choice.
To need a set of scorecards up here for our favourite careers.
I'm DPD.
I say that's two votes for DPD.
Yeah, I'm going there. You got two for Evri. Where are you going, Bryony?
I might go Evri because I've got a really lovely Evri lady.
We spoke about this earlier. So we spoke about loving Evri because of our specific delivery drivers.
Yeah, because you get attached to them. And yes, that's their relationship builds.
And again, it's the experience. It goes back to the experience that they give.
Yeah.
Well, we're starting to talk about really what matters to people at an individual level here. Mm-hmm. What matters to luxury customers really most? You know, when all said and done, if they've got the money, they could shop anywhere, do anything. You know, they can even get a personal shop to pick it up for them if necessary. Mm-hmm. But really, what are the sweet spots that a luxury customer is looking for?
It's not so easy to answer because I think it depends on what they're buying into. If you're at the fashion sort of side of luxury, I think there is an element of exclusivity. I think if you're into home and lifestyle, I think it's going to be delivery is going to be really important because you're spending a lot of money on your item. Every particular customer need will have a very different requirement. So we can't just apply a blanket approach. You have to really offer different sort of levels of engagement and personalization or exclusivity. And I think that's what makes it a really great experience and connection between the retailer and the shopper.
Just to carry on from Sarah's point on that, it's different.
Matt.
It's different for every customer. This is what makes it difficult. If there was a simple answer to what we all need to deliver to demanding luxury customers, then we'd all do it unfailingly and life would be easy. I think the challenge is that it's different for every single customer. Mm-hmm. And the challenge we've got is personalisation. And sometimes the customer won't even know that they've received something personalised. It will just be that we have presented the right thing to them at the right point in the journey, whether that's the right delivery choice. We've pre-selected their collect store because we know they always click and collect from that store. It's those little things that may even go unnoticed, but they make life easier for the customer. They reduce that kind of psychological drag that stops us from kind of continuing through digital journey.
And Sarah, in your experience, what elements of the luxury post-purchase experience are most critical in delivering lifetime value?
God, I don't know if you can just sort of attribute it to one thing. I think trust. Sort of that trust and confidence is, I think, a really key part. And then you can layer on the emotional connection. And, you know, a way that you drive loyalty is by being able to attach emotion to your brand. So if you can get a customer to feel like really excited or really happy when they receive your item or they, you know, they're sort of putting on what they purchased from you, that is going to drive customer loyalty. Which is great. retention is a trust game. It's a trust exchange, because otherwise the risk is I'm never going to come back and shop online. I might go into the store, but I, you know, it's too important. You let me down last time, I'm not going to risk it. So I think that sometimes it's the basic. And then if you can layer on top of that the sort of emotional connection and then the packaging and then making them feel good about, you know, the environment because, you know, whatever it might be, I think, you know, it has to be, come from a base of trust.
How, Bryony, do you perceive returns? You know, is it something which is just part of doing business, or is it a way of being able to re-engage with shoppers?
It's never going to go away. It's always going to be a really integral part of the order experience for all of our customers. I think clothing will forever have returns existing in our world. So it's more a case of making the experience the best it can be, keeping those customers engaged so they do shop again. I think to Sarah and Matt's point, if you give any reason to have that break in trust or seamlessness, it opens that gap for the customer to think, will I shop with you again? And we've got to make sure we don't allow that gap to occur so they do come back.
And where do you stand as a company? What's your policy? Is it free returns? Is it do you demand a certain value before people can purchase? What's the deal?
We do offer free returns.
And how about you, Matt?
So we offer free returns to our store, and we offer free exchanges for a different size through couriers. If you want to send your whole order back for a refund, then we do deduct the courier cost. So £2.95 is deducted from the.
So I think recently, famously, Zara and H&M both implemented what are called pain policies, I guess, to try and discourage people doing returns. In your experience, do pain policies actually deliver any benefit, or are they just bad for shoppers?
I mean, in our case, you know, we very much presented that as that is the cost of the return courier. So most of our customers are not paying for delivery outbound. And if they do not want to return to one of our stores, they don't want to exchange the product for something else, then we do deduct that return courier cost. I think the biggest impact that had, alongside bringing on the Narvar portal, was to get customers to think, well, there is a real cost to this. Mm. If I send this back by courier, they are going to deduct that £2.95. And that's, you know, that's clearly sounds about the right cost for a courier to return these goods. But what they're presenting to me in this returns journey online is the ability to return the goods to my local store. And a lot of customers just haven't considered that. So I think it's that taking customers through that digital journey and presenting them that option and where their nearest store is, and the, I guess, the if that's the carrot, then the stick of the £2.95 is going to be deducted, has really helped us to drive a lot more of our returns into store. So we used to have about a third of our returns would be taken into our store. It's now 60% of our returns of goods purchased online are taken back into our store. And that obviously gives us that much better opportunity to talk to customers, understand what it is about the product that's not right, whether it's the fit, the size, the colour, the style, whatever, and put that right. And so we're able to retain a lot more customer value.
A final thought from everyone, please. I guess the last question. How do you retain your brand exclusivity and perhaps that perception of luxury through the returns process? I mean, look, it's a gritty process, isn't it? You know, however you do it, you've still got to, you know, put those goods back in the bag or box and hand them over to another person. But how do you still create that brand, almost brand envelope that wraps the whole thing together nicely?
I think for us, it's just making sure it's delivering on our promises, to Kelly's point. So ultimately, the customer wants their money back, but they want a good branded experience, just like everything else. Just because returns are perhaps negative to the business, it is just an integral part of shopping for clothing online. So to make sure that we deliver the same expectations and experiences we would when they order, which is what we're wanting, you know, customers to do from a digital perspective, is really important that we don't put preference over one journey over the other.
And Kelly, you work with many different retailers which are trying to achieve the same thing, but perhaps through a different brand lens.
Yeah.
How do you protect those branded golden moments?
I think it's with choice. I think it's allowing the retailer to offer their customers choice so it doesn't feel like an effort, so that you're not encouraging customers to go out of their way to return the items. So by offering choice, it improves that customer experience. It improves, again, like you say, returns are negative, that retailers don't really want them. But by making it as easy as you can, it ends on an overall positive experience. And that, again, goes back to the brand loyalty. That goes back to wanting to re-engage with the brand again in the future. So it's about being able to make sure that your customers feel like it's easy to interact with you at every stage, even in things such as returns.
Mm. And Matt, if you're now driving 60% of your returns back to store, surely that gives you an amazing opportunity to really seal the deal and the end of that transaction in whatever form with that one-to-one in-person experience.
Absolutely. There's nothing quite like the experience that we're able to deliver in store, no matter how much we try to digitally replicate that and provide great online experiences. We are always going to have a much better relationship with a customer in store and having a conversation with them about, you know, what event it is that they're shopping with us for, or the purpose for buying with us. I think, in terms of just, trying to use that returns process to deliver a better experience, I think, one of the things that we've done is also around exchanges. So for a customer that does just want to do a simple size swap and can't take the product into the store, it's just not convenient, we offer online exchanges. By having the courier returns data plugged into our systems, the minute we see that a customer has dropped that return product off at the post office or whatever drop-off point, we release the size that they are exchanging for. So, they can book a return today for an exchange, drop it off at the post office, and the new size will be sent out and dispatched to them today. And the customer's got visibility of that. And it's about using the visibility of the data that we've got to just try and improve that customer experience and show that we trust the customer as much as they trust us and release those exchanges as soon as we can.
And Sarah, in your very wide experience in the luxury market and specifically at Narval, as a conscience for the brand, I guess, that you can keep looking and nudging and sort of saying, we need to change this and do that and offer that. What do you think are one of the kind of the key lessons about how do you really protect that luxury brand experience?
I think you really have to understand and be able to mine the data effectively to understand and create this matrix. You're going to have a customer who's buying more, whose propensity is more towards one category of your department store or your range than another. So I think it's mining the data to really ensure that sort of hyper-personalized experience. I think then it's about ensuring that you match the deliverables with the customer's expectations, whilst also remembering and thinking, what are my customer's expectations? What are their priorities? And also sometimes the highest spenders are the highest maintenance customers who have no loyalty. And why should they? For them, it's about they can shop anywhere. So remember that. And then I think it's about communicating. I think if people were, brands and retailers had a sort of quite a, we have to start communicating the true cost of returns to the consumer, because the consumer can't think that it's just this, someone's paying for it. If it's not the retailer, because then that's going to come back and bite them in terms of potential increase of delivery charges or whatever it might be, because you've got to pay for it somehow. Or it might be an impact to the environment. And I think we've got to sort of just have these, not be too scared to have strong communication with the customer and explain and take them on the journey with them. Because we're not, as consumers, we're adults, we understand the realities that we are living in. From an environmental perspective as well. So, let us also feel like we're part of the solution and not just seen as the problem from a shopper perspective.
Well, thank you very much, panel, for some really fascinating insights there. All it remains to do is for me to say a final thank you to our panel today. Bryony Yates, Senior CX Manager from Seasalt Cornwall. Kelly Kors, Enterprise Customer Success Manager for Narval. Sarah Curran, retail expert at Narval, and our only other male on the panel, Matthew Henton, who is head of e-commerce from Moss. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Retail Exchange podcast. Subscribe online at theretailexchange.co.uk and join the debate. #RetailExchange. Thanks for listening.